I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we'll talk about faith, spirituality, and religion. According to annual Gallup polls, the United States ranks as one of the most religious countries in the world. More than 90% of Americans say they pray daily. Nearly two-thirds of us say that we belong to an organized church or synagogue. Those numbers have stayed pretty much the same for the past 50 years. What has changed is the form of religious expression in this country. In 1948, 91% of Americans said they were Christians. Now, 77% do. That means that more than 10%, or 90% of Americans who say they pray daily, worship in a tradition other than Christianity. What does all this mean? We'll talk about it today with religious leaders from several denominations, and you. We'll take your calls at 866-476-3881, your emails at nolimits@wfyi.org, and your comments via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. Please do join the conversation. But first, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. Glad to have you with us today. We are talking today about the issues of spirituality, faith, and religion. We're fortunate to have as our guests Betty Brandt, who is the Director of Spiritual Life at St. Luke's United Methodist Church. Betty, welcome to the program.
Thank
Good to
you,
have
John.
You here. Michael Sahir, Imam of Nur Allah Islamic Center here in Indianapolis. Michael, thank you for joining us today. And Carol Johnston, Associate Professor of Theology and Culture at Christian Theological Seminary. Carol, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you all here. We also would like to invite our listeners to join this conversation, which promises to be a fascinating one. And you can do that by calling us at toll-free at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send comments or questions via Twitter and Facebook at WFYI. We're going to start the conversation, as we saw in the setup, America generally, United States generally, ranks as one of the most religious countries in the world by the Gallup surveys and some of the other indicators. Only Malta ranks as higher in terms of placing a value on religious faith and expression. And I'll toss out the question, why is that? Why is the United States, why are people in the United States as devoted to religious faith and religious expression as they are? I think I'll start with Carol Johnston on that one.
Thanks. There's a lot of people have thought about this for a long time, and the consensus pretty much is religious freedom. It's that simple. For centuries in Western Europe, people thought that if you had more than one religion in one state, you would have chaos, you would have conflict. And when religious differences arose, actually there was a lot of conflict. So when the colonists got to the New World, Roger Williams in the Rhode Island colony in the 1600s said, let's try an experiment. Let's let everybody follow whatever religion they want to. And it has worked brilliantly.
Betty, your thoughts. Betty Brandt.
Well, I think that one of the things that we have to remember is that prayer or some kind of expression of belief in God does not necessarily mean that people claim the religious title for themselves. They may think of themselves as spiritual, or they may think of themselves as having some belief in God, but they wouldn't say that they are religious. In fact, a lot of people would stay away from calling themselves religious, even though they are prayerful and maybe devoted to God in ways that we would honor.
That's a point I want to pick up, I think, a little bit later on about that, you know, whether there is some sort of stigma that's attached to saying that you are religious or whatever in this country. Michael, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, my thoughts are, even as small children in grade school, you know, we're taught one nation under God. So it's also ingrained in the education that we receive from kindergarten or even before. As we are told that our first 7 years are our formative years. And so it's really put into us at an early age. And as life progresses and we grow and we run into situations that we tend to fall back on that formation that we received as toddlers.
And I want to talk a little bit about the other, the point that we saw in the setup too, that well, I guess it's closer now to 60 some years ago, in the Gallup poll, and admittedly we could have a discussion about how accurate that might be. 91% of the people surveyed then identified themselves as Christian in this country. Now the number is at 77%, which means we're seeing a much larger portion of the population as non-Christian. What has brought about those changes? And, you know, I realize we probably could spend the whole hour just talking about this. What, not only what caused those changes, but what do those changes really mean? How has it affected life and religious expression in this country? And I'll throw that one, I think, first to Betty Brand.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think that there's been a couple of major things that have happened. One of them is, of course, immigration. As people come in to the United States from all over the world, they bring their culture, they bring their faith, they bring everything with them. So once they get to this country, then it falls back to what Carol was talking about, that in a nation where religious freedom is possible, they can go ahead and worship as they want to worship. They're not thrown into some state religion. The other thing that I think has happened is that as Eastern religions have become more available and popular in the United States, I know a number of people who have left Christianity and have become Buddhists. They certainly grew up in a Christian church, but they turned away from Christianity and went to some other religion. And I think that is a major influx of a whole other faith tradition into our culture.
Michael, you're nodding your head up and down. Michael Sahir.
I'm just listening. I'm thinking we're living in a world now of mass communications. You know, we have internet, we have ways of contacting people that before we could not hear outside of our particular upbringing, but now that has changed quite a bit. I was born and raised Christian, but I became Muslim later on in life. There was more access to information and more to consider, more to weigh. And so people began to make decisions based upon their life upbringing, of course, but things, new information, or a different expression of saying that there is a God. And so we just weigh things and make considerations and make choices.
Could we? I'm actually going to deviate from my script here a little bit because I think you've said something, at least that I am curious about, and I suspect other people would be. Could you talk a little bit about what your conversion experience was like?
Sure.
How you moved from Christianity to Islam?
Well, I don't think I moved from Christianity.
Okay.
I think I just went to a different expression of faith. Because my family is still Christian, by and large. I have one brother who converted as well. But to say that I moved from it would see that I left something, and I don't think that I left it. I think that I just went to a different perspective. But my conversion, as they're called conversions, some call it reversions, going back too. But from my experience as an African-American, Islam is taught in the 60s and the 70s was not the proper Islam. It was the Nation of Islam, which had a high racial and nationalistic overtones to it. But the generation that I raised in, the 60s and the 70s, we had all kind of changes going on within our social fabric. The Black Panther movement, the Black Power movement, then we had young Caucasian white Americans with the hippies, and there was a lot of rebellion going on in the 60s. And in the 70s, we're trying to make sense of self and to qualify us as being dignified human beings. So when I heard the message of Islam, that spoke more to what I thought of myself. And so it was just going toward that which agreed more with my thinking before. And a lot of things I would think about of Christian teachings, there was no one to talk to it about. But with the Muslims, it was like that was their headline topic for the day. So it was like I found a group that thinks like me. And
what were the things, when you say that it's a group that thinks like you, what were the points of connection for you?
Keep in mind, there was a lot of racial overtones, mm-hmm. not only in society, but also within religious circles. When you had a religion that was designed to speak to a void in African Americans, mm-hmm. that's where the connection was, to where they would question, you know, the racial colorings in religion. And so that was one thing, you know, the Caucasian figure of the Christ figure, the angels being white, and so on and so on. So the Nation of Islam was designed.
Whether that's historically accurate or not is right. a whole other question.
Well, that's very true. But still, that was a dominant theme. You couldn't go into anyone's home and not see the Caucasian Jesus mm-hmm. somewhere. And so for me as an African-American, I'm like, that doesn't quite fit. So the Nation of Islam gave a platform to at least to address that need. But then on a theological perspective, I never could figure how the Father and the Son are going to be the same person. That never settled with me. And so in Islam is even Islam as a pure sense, as the monotheistic idea was very, very much adhered to. And so that really connected with me.
Is that that really diversity of religious experience is in some ways is Michael's experience been a microcosm for what's gone on in this country in the past 60 years, where faith is, I mean, in some ways, and I realize I do not want to demean your experience or oversimplify it in any way, but it sounds like the point of connection there really was that you found a faith tradition that was more immediately relevant
yes,
to your
true.
Life circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't say until relatively recently many churches worried all that much about being relevant. Is that a fair assessment or not? Carol Johnston, you're looking at me in a perplexed fashion.
Well,
here.
I think it's intensified in recent years. There's always been a very lively strain of American religion that has worked very much at being relevant to spiritual search. And American individualism means people have felt free often to change, often not until after they've become assimilated as Americans, a mm-hmm. generation or two after immigration. People start looking around. And I was going to say 60 years ago, that Gallup poll you mentioned about religion would never have put all Christians together because mm-hmm. the great divide mm-hmm. in America was between Catholics and Protestants.
Mm-hmm.
And Catholics were still
struggling. Oh, and they still separated out in the poll.
Were still struggling
yeah.
to be accepted in the mainstream mm-hmm. of America. There were tremendous religious riots against Catholics many years ago. Also for Jews, it was a very long struggle of a century, really, to be accepted in the mainstream. So, yes, people change religions in this country probably more than anywhere else in the world. I don't know if anyone's studied that. I myself was not brought up Presbyterian. I was brought up very anti-Christian and found Christianity to be more helpful than
sounds
anything
like we
else.
Have another story here. I
mean, well,
we're getting close to a break, and I think that's going to involve a little more discussion.
Okay.
I probably will bring it back to you. But Betty Brandt, I guess part of where, to oversimplify this question, when I look at your job title as Director of Spiritual Life, I mean, in some ways that's about connecting with the congregation. If I'd gone to a Methodist church 150 years ago, in all likelihood, there would not have been a director of spiritual life position. Is that more about the church's attempt to reach out and connect with people?
Actually, if you would go to probably any other church right now, you wouldn't find a director of mm-hmm. spiritual life either, because it's usually under adult ed.
Mm-hmm.
But because St. Luke's is so big, it's separated out, and my job is very experiential. I have all the stuff like meditation and the labyrinth and yoga and the art and movies and all those kinds of things fall under that experiential part of spiritual life rather than what's traditionally thought of as adult education within the church.
You are listening to No Limits. I'm John Krall. We're coming up on a break right now, but I would like to invite our callers to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can send your emails at nolimits@wfyi.org or send comments or questions via Twitter or Facebook at WFYI. We're going to take just a moment to thank the folks who have made this program possible. Pick it up in just a minute. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by your membership and by the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's presentation of Handel's Messiah, performed in the Neo-Gothic Sanctuary of Tabernacle Presbyterian Church, December 11th and 12th. More at icomusic.org. And by All American Picnic Company, offering a holiday office party luncheon with turkey or ham and seasonal trimmings. Information at allamericanpicnic.com. Find out what's happening in arts and culture in Central Indiana this weekend on The Art of the Matter, right here on 90.1, Friday evening at 8 and Saturday afternoons at 4. Made possible by listeners like you, with major support from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts opening in January. You're tuned to No Limits here on WFYI 90.1 FM for your information. WFYI Radio is streaming online. Listen in at wfyi.org/radio and catch both our HD1 and HD2 broadcasts.
Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today about spirituality, faith, and religion. We're fortunate to have as our guests Betty Brandt, Director of Spiritual Life, St. Luke's United Methodist Church, Michael Sahir, Imam of Nur Allah Islamic Center here in Indianapolis, Carol Johnston, Associate Professor of Theology and Culture at the Christian Theological Seminary. Carol, before the break, you were mentioning that you were raised almost anti-Christian, and your conversion experience was almost a kind of a mirror image of Michael's. I'd like for you to talk a little bit about that, share your story, if that's possible.
I'd be happy to.
Thanks.
In some ways, I would agree with Michael. It's not that I left behind everything I was raised with, not at all. I really appreciate a lot of the Unitarianism I grew up with. Mm-hmm. But what I discovered by the time I was 15 was, what I was taught was that if science can't prove it, it can't be true. And I realized one of the things they would talk about is things in the Bible, like the story of Jonah and the whale. And it dawned on me that the whole thing about did the whale swallow Jonah or not is actually the wrong question. Mm-hmm. And the Unitarians and the fundamentalists were both asking the same question. The fundamentalists said yes because the Bible says so. The Unitarian says no because science says it can't happen. But it's the wrong question. It's not what the story's about.
What is the right question?
The right question is, what is the truth being taught to us about God's mercy and compassion in the world that this story is all about?
Well, and that gets to sort of that whole question of, that I think divides a lot of religious people, and gets to the issue that Betty Brandt was raising earlier about the stigma attached to, people who express their religious faith openly. Whether you accept the whole idea of biblical inerrancy, the fact that the Bible is a literally true document, or whether it is something more metaphoric or not, I think the perception, at least of the public, that if you say you are religious, it means at some level that you are fundamentalist or at least evangelical. Is that the case, Betty?
I do think that there is that thinking afoot today that all Christians are evangelicals or fundamentalists in some way. And I think that's very far from the truth, but the media, I know I'm sitting here as part of the media, in some way encourages that, I believe. And the diversity within Christianity is sometimes overlooked. Since I'm part of a church, it's part of my responsibility to get out other ideas about what's the variety of the Christian faith. So I bear some responsibility in that, I think, as well as other lots of other people as well.
Well, and I guess I'd, in picking up on that whole discussion of how much of the text and of the three representatives I hear, there is a sacred text in each case. Do you take that as the inerrant word of God, or do you interpret it as Carol suggested? I'll throw this, Michael. You've been silent for a couple of minutes, and I can't let anyone relax on this program.
Okay.
So.
Yes, I see my text as being without error in the original language of the Arabic. Now, that doesn't mean the person reading it doesn't come and bring error to it or take an error from it. We're taught that God trusts our brains as we struggle to learn. And also that if we were to look at every passage as being literal, which has caused a lot of trouble for people around the world, Muslims taking too much of the Quran literal, then that's not what we believe God wants us to see. But at the same time, that if it's a book for all times, then we have to know that it is maybe a little bit ahead of us at all times, and that we are still growing into understandings of it. It is quite a mercy, I will say, to have Bible and Quran and other books of writings of different religions that have probably more information in it than we are ready to even appreciate.
Carol Johnston, Christian Theological Seminary.
I count myself as very much a religious Christian and practicing Christian, but I do not think reading the Bible literally is the right way to go, because it's a modern idea. It was never read literally, as if all that mattered was whether you take the language literally. It was read as the rule of faith, a witness to the Word of God, which for us is Jesus Christ. So I take that into account.
Okay. And I think of the Bible as a library.
Yeah.
That it has books of history, it has books of poetry, it has books of wisdom, it has books of story, it has all sorts of elements. It's not linear. It's not just a single thing. It has so much element to it. So that to take it all literally denies the complexity that is within the text itself.
I'm finding this conversation fascinating and wish, frankly, I could just continue it, but that almost would be selfish. We've got a lot of callers now, so I'm going to integrate them into the conversation if possible, because I, much as I would like to, I shouldn't monopolize things. Abda, are you on the line?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for calling. I gather you're from Canada and you're driving through Indianapolis.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to Texas. I'm on the road. I'm in Indianapolis right now.
Great.
And I'm listening to you. I want just to say I'm Muslim. And I'm Muslim, and I'm just feeling in United States or in each state that I'm practicing my religion like I'm in my original country. And the point that I want to mention and to talk about is this kind of freedom.
Oops.
Oh.
I think we dropped that call. Mm. I think where he was going with that question is the question really about the freedom, whether it draws people from different parts of the world to the West. Is that the case, Michael? Sahir, you were holding your hand up.
Yeah. So on that point there, what I found interesting with we mentioned about immigration, and there have been quite a few Muslims who I've become friends with from around the world, and they have more than once said that they were able to practice Islam better and freer in America than in their home countries. I heard that from not just from one country, but from numerous Muslims from numerous countries, that they have been able to practice Islam better here than in their home country.
Yeah, I know there's a book I read years ago by Gary Wills, under God who makes the argument that I think Carroll actually advanced, that part of the reason religious expression in this country is so energetic is because we built a wall separating church and state earlier than most other countries, and we've adhered to it more faithfully. Is that, Carol, is that a fair assessment? Or?
I think that's a big part of it. And also, one of the things that does, it means you can't take your faith for granted.
Mm-hmm.
In countries that are almost totally Muslim or almost totally Catholic, people tend to, okay, it's just everywhere, so that means it's nowhere. You don't have to be as serious about it as if you're going to practice mm-hmm. a tradition here. You really do have to think about what you're doing and why bother in this context in a way that you don't elsewhere.
Well, and I think that the question that springs to mind is, as we see religious expression and faith traditions multiplying in this country, religious expression becoming somewhat less monolithic, perhaps, than it was in the past. I am keeping in mind that Carol Johnston made the point earlier that it was never as monolithic as we like to think of in the past. Has that actually sort of sharpened the form as interfaith dialogue? In effect, is one hesitates to use the argument that try to apply market principles to questions of faith, but we say in a marketplace that competition sharpens things. Does it do so when it comes to religious expression?
You mean with now interfaith, from my experience in Indianapolis, is I think it's quite powerful,
mm-hmm.
and it's growing quite a bit. There have been institutions set up in Indianapolis, a number of them, based upon interfaith, and we have built homes. With St. Luke's Church and Habitat for Humanity, at least four homes built in this city called House of Abraham, built with Muslims, Christians, and Jews. So it was sharpened in the sense that it will allow us and maybe obligate us to come out of our comfort zone of our own religion to have the courage to go and meet someone of a different religion, not in a dialogue situation, but doing the actual hands-on product, and which has even led us to build a house over in Jordan in 2008. We got together and collected money and went overseas and built a house. So interfaith is really a very powerful institution in Indianapolis.
Carol Johnston.
It's also true that when you engage with people from another faith tradition, you do have to think about, well, what do we believe? Again, you can't take it for granted. So I think that's quite right. One of the best leaders of interfaith projects in the country is Eboo Patel in Chicago, who founded Interfaith Youth Corps. And one of the things that often surprises the college students who participate is that he insists that they articulate their own faith to each other, that they're not just there to learn about somebody else's. They're there to learn who they are, too. And it's not that they're encouraging people to convert, just the opposite. They're encouraging them to understand themselves as well as each other.
We're going to take another caller. Carolyn?
Yes?
Good to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Oh, certainly glad to do so. What is your question?
My question was, among this question for the three panelists, all of them,
certainly.
How do you keep your members engaged in the church and belief, and how you make them a part of what's going on in the church so they won't, you know, become discouraged to maybe become weak in their faith?
Who would like to take that one first? Betty Brandt.
Well, I'll say something about that. Mm-hmm. St. Luke's is very large, so we have the ability to offer lots of different programs. But we have found that engaging people in service to others is the best way mm-hmm. of keeping them involved in their own faith, their own personal faith, so that every time there is some kind of effort to go out into the community or to do a work project or to in some way go past the confines of our own walls, I think people not only serve others, but they grow in their own faith at the same time.
Carol Johnston.
I've been looking at a number of congregations around the country, and one of the questions was indeed, how do you engage people? And the secret, it turns out, is the practice of hospitality. When people feel welcome, and welcome in the sense that they themselves are valued, not just that they're there and therefore you can get them to do stuff, but that they're welcomed to participate in their own way, and with the premise that everybody has gifts to offer. So welcoming people and then inviting them to share their gifts with each other so that they encourage each other and help each other is really very effective.
Michael Sahir.
Well, I would first say I would ditto to both, because what they said is very much true for our faith. But with Islam being in the news every evening, and most times not in a positive way, we also have to do a lot of education to our members so that they can know their religion as a Muslim should know their own religion. You mentioned about how Eboo Patel mentioned that the person should not just learn the other faith, but also learn their own faith. So with the way that we are portrayed on a regular basis in the media, it is incumbent for us to also teach our membership about their own religion so that they become educated in their religion.
Well, and I guess that leads to another question, too, is even though there is a lot of religious energy in this country, we seem to keep coming back to this theme of education, too. How well are religious issues, challenges understood in this country? Carol Johnston just rolled her eyes at me, so I'll take that as a cue that you have some thoughts on the subject.
Well, I think it's a very mixed picture, a wildly mixed picture. Partly it's because religion is a do-it-yourself thing. People are searching and looking for spirituality anywhere they can find it. And even within congregations, people are often, because they haven't been brought up in the tradition or because they haven't been well taught in the tradition, they don't know very much about their own tradition, let alone others. So and it's getting harder. It's not getting easier.
Well, and I guess part of where I draw this, the book I referenced earlier, Gary Will's book, Under God, he has this, for someone who has been a working journalist for most of his life, I saw as a pretty significant indictment where he was covering an Operation Rescue event, anti-abortion group, and Randall Terry, who was one of the organizers, the leader of that movement, was apparently talking to a group of reporters, including some from the New York Times, and the reporters came back and said, you know, Terry is scaring everybody with these horror stories, when in fact he was quoting from the Book of Revelations. Mm. The New York Times reporters did not catch that. Is the depth of religious understanding and knowledge not as profound as we would hope it would be? Betty Brandt, you're shaking your head up and down.
Yeah, we talk about this a lot at meetings, that oftentimes children get brought to Sunday school, they get brought to church, and they stay with that education until maybe they're in the sixth or seventh grade. And then there begins to be a wandering away, so that their education gets cut off at a level of maybe a 11 or 12-year-old understanding. And very few people are going to teach Revelations to a 10-year-old. They're just not going to go there. So that a lot of adults, even though they may have been to Sunday school or some other religious education as a child, never, in academic terms, never took the 201 classes and the 301 classes and the 401 classes. They got cut off at grade school, and that's all they know.
Is that your perception, too, Carol Johnston?
Yes, it is. I meet a lot of people who have abandoned Christianity, largely because they're carrying around an idea of it of a 10-year-old. They've never explored it as an adult. They've never learned how to become an intentional Catholic, an intentional Presbyterian. So they're left with ideas that are just not what it could be. And again, as I said, it's kind of a struggle to deal with that. And I have to say, you mentioned religion reporting. The quality of religion reporting in this country is pretty poor. I don't see that reporters really try very hard to connect with people who are knowledgeable.
Present company excluded.
Of course. And I have had some good, very good experiences with some fine reporters, okay. But for the most part, it's either we don't want to mention it at all, or it's chase the most extreme versions of a religious tradition without appreciating the constructive side of the people in the tradition, without really getting to know who the real religious leaders actually are. Mm-hmm. And that's not just reporters. I found that with politicians as well. I've tried to do a lot of educating with people about the fact that just because you happen to have found a rabbi or a pastor, if they don't have a congregation and aren't well regarded by their own community, you're not doing anything very effective interfaith-wise or community-wise. So there's all those issues.
We're going to take a short break right now to thank the people who have made this program possible. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. We'll be back in 1 minute.
No Limits is made possible by your membership and by Terry Lee Honda and Avon, offering options in car buying. First-time visits are for fact-finding to enable informed buying decisions with all the information. That's TLC, the Terry Lee Commitment. More at terryleehonda.com. And by Global Gifts, a fair trade store providing unique international gift ideas for the holidays. Global Gifts, making a difference one purchase at a time. Information at globalgiftsindy.com. Every day, WFYI member card holders are saving money at restaurants like Hot Box Pizza, Qdoba Mexican Grill, and Three Sisters Cafe and Bakery. Complete benefit listings are online at WFYI.org. To find out how to get your own member card, call 636-2020. You're tuned to No Limits here on WFYI 90.1 FM for your information. To stay up to date with WFYI, follow us on Facebook or at Twitter at WFYI.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're having a fascinating conversation about spirituality, faith, and religion. I've really enjoyed the calls we have gotten on this subject. Our guests today are Betty Brandt, who is the director of Spiritual Life at St. Luke's United Methodist Church, Michael Sahir, imam of Nur Allah Islamic Center here in Indianapolis, Carol Johnston, Associate Professor of Theology and Culture at Christian Theological Seminary. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. That's a toll-free call. You also can send questions via email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send questions or comments via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. We were really talking about the depth of understanding and to some degree whether faith traditions get almost caricatured. Carol Johnston was making the case that the folks in my profession don't always do the best job of covering either the breadth or the depth of religious expression in this country. But I would think probably, particularly in the past few years, that the attention devoted to Islam and to Muslims, in some ways, has been the most caricatured over the past decade or so. What is that experience like for someone in your faith tradition, Michael Sahir? And what do you try to do about it as a religious leader?
Well, it can be a challenge, and I think we come to the point of, what do we do with a challenge? And it's been used by us as opportunities to teach and to share. When you are, I'm really on a daily basis, you know, portrayed wrong. Mm-hmm. Not just in the media, but we hear politicians, big, important politicians, doing the same thing of mischaracterizing Muslims, and then we hear religious leaders, important religious leaders, doing the same thing. So it becomes an opportunity to every chance we get, and we thank you for this show to share with people
it's our pleasure.
A more correct perspective, you were asking before about education.
Mm-hmm.
It really obligates us to become educated about being Muslim. It does help that, and even for our youth, is middle school and high school even, that they somehow become the classroom expert on Islam because they got the name Muhammad, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But then also, which may be where in Islam is very normal, because every month during the month of Ramadan we read the whole Quran,
mm-hmm.
and so many of our youth have read the entire Quran from cover to cover 5, 6, 10 times maybe. By the time they get into college, they read the whole book over and over again. That's important because mm-hmm. we're going to be challenged, and some challenges come good. We have an interfaith, and those are good, healthy, you know, conversations of a challenge. But then there are some that come at you in a negative way. We have to be ready. We're talking about faith and spirituality. You have to be balanced there to be able to continue with the right spirit to encounter a question that you know you just answered that question last time.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still maybe that fear factor that is in the air mm-hmm. about Islam. Then there are those who just don't want to know. I think we recently witnessed the pastor in Florida. He went from one position to after some encounters. Not that he changed himself. He shouldn't change himself. But I think his thinking changed after he encountered. So, yes, we are often not shown correctly. But it's an opportunity, you know, to teach and to share. And that has always been a very successful encounter.
Mm-hmm. Carol Johnston, Christian Theological Seminary.
I've encountered a lot of fear of Muslims. In fact, some of it has been really heart-wrenching, how afraid people are who ordinarily wouldn't be. And I think a lot of it has been the kind of emphasis that's been on the airways about Muslims that's quite unfair. And I'd also like to mention that one of our dear friends is K.P. Singh, who's mm-hmm. a Sikh,
mm-hmm.
Originally from India. And Sikhs are not Muslims, but because they wear turbans, they get a lot of discrimination and some real struggles. And KP is one of the most enthusiastic mm-hmm. Americans you will ever want to meet. I mean, mm-hmm. he That's loves right. this country yes. deeply, deeply. But since 9/11, he is no longer able to travel around Indiana towns to mm-hmm. do his artwork of county seats that he's famous for without calling ahead of time and getting the police so that they know he's coming and all kinds of stuff. Because people just assume, the man with a turban, he must be a terrorist. It's really been difficult.
Well, and I guess part of the point that Carol was making before we went to the break about the discomfort that we have at times talking about religious issues in this country, that you cited the religious reporting, and you're right. By and large, most newspapers, relegate religious coverage to what those of us who used to be in the business used to call the vitamin pages, B6, B7, back away. And religious programming for most commercial television radio stations is in off hours when not a whole lot of people are listening or watching. What accounts for that sense of discomfort? It ties into a question we've gotten from Steve, who wants to know why people are stigmatized for expressing religion. Mm-hmm. I think it's a broader question of just what creates the sense of discomfort.
Mm-hmm. I think it might go back to the old idea about don't talk religion, politics, mm-hmm. money, sex, the list of the things you're not supposed to talk about, because there's bound to be a variety.
All of the things, though, that are important to people.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so as we back away from the things that are really important to us, all the other things show up that maybe are there in the society but are not as important to us. They may be more unique, a happening that doesn't happen every day gets the news, whereas somebody praying every day, that's not important enough to get the headlines. So we back away from the important things and show the things that are maybe once or twice that happen a week.
Your thoughts, Carol Johnston.
I think there's a lot of confusion about separation of church and state, and there's been a lot of people are there's also a lot of anxiety about offending people. So a lot of people, you know, don't talk about religion, sex, or politics in the sense of if we disagree, then we won't be able to get along with each other, and that's threatening. On the other hand, I find that the more secure people are in their faith tradition and in themselves, the more easily they can talk to people who are different, or they can interact with people who are different. So it's a measure, in a sense, of insecurity in our culture about these matters. And, of course, the public struggle over what's appropriate in terms of religion in the public square and what isn't has gone on from the very beginning. So that's nothing new and nothing surprising. That's part of the American experiment.
And let me take it one step further with Michael Sahir. Michael, when you encounter someone, you've talked eloquently about, you know, the misperceptions of your faith. When you encounter someone who doesn't have an accurate understanding, is perhaps uncomfortable with talking with a Muslim, how do you deal with that situation?
Well, since I don't wear a turban and a long dress, sometimes they have spoken with me. We had the conversation, and they didn't know I was Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
So we know what it is. No, it's fear of the unknown. It's someone who may not find the ability to come out of their comfort zone. Those which you don't know, you just don't know. You just stay where you think you belong. So it's just opportunities, once again, to where you ask questions. And I guess one advantage that I do have, being raised in the church, I know enough Christian points, you know, to where I can transfer the conversation.
Do you have a lot of those conversations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I tell you, and I'm going to share this here.
Sure. That's why we're here.
A lot of people, they ask me about jihad.
Yeah.
What is this jihad? It's a holy war. I said, no, no war is holy. War is never holy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe necessary, but war is never holy. But then I said, well, let me take the benefits I've been given, born and raised American. Born and raised Christian. Now I'm Muslim, and I'm still American. I said, better than me try to explain it in a Islamic context, let me find an identical American context that suits the title jihad.
Mm-hmm.
And when I began to say the Boston Tea Party was a jihad, the American Revolution was a jihad.
Mm-hmm.
They say, well, how is that? Because someone was trying to stop me from worshiping God as God told me I should be free to.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, as a response to them trying to oppress me, I have to defend myself. That is jihad. The Boston Tea Party is the best example that any American can take. And I know people got to think on it for a while. Mm-hmm. But that is the truest spirit of jihad. It's that I want to serve God. You want to stop me from serving God. You're not going to stop me from serving God. I'm going to go over here. I'm going with the Europeans. We're going to leave. We're going to come over here. Okay? The British chased them over here, right? And they say, okay, now I'm not going to keep running from you. I'm going to stop here and fight you. Boston Tea Party, American Revolution. That is the best meaning of jihad. So these kind of conversations are come up. And I would take it to that point to where put the issue that you think you have a problem with in Islam, put it in American Christian language, and then they can begin to see the point. And I love it.
And is that, in some ways, is that the secret to having meaningful interfaith dialogue, is that you try to reach across and understand each other's traditions and all of that. Carol Johnston.
Most definitely, and it's really the case that actually there's one of my favorite posters I ever saw was of a Cape buffalo from Africa, one of the most dangerous animals in the world, with a little bird sitting on top of it. And it said, familiarity breeds confidence. And that's exactly what we're talking about. There's all kinds of evidence that the more people know someone from a different faith tradition, the less anxious they are about it and the more willing they are to engage. So it's relationships. When we know each other, we can figure it out. If we don't know someone, if it's these scary people that we don't know anything about but what we hear, then you have all kinds of problems.
We've got about a couple of minutes left. What is the biggest challenge confronting us right now when it comes to, you know, understanding religious expression in this country? And I hesitate to use the words divides because I think we are manning to bridge most of those right now in this kind of conversation. But what is the biggest challenge out there right now? Michael, you're looking very intently at me. Michael, sit here.
Well, there's quite a few. But the one that comes strongest to my mind now is for religious leadership to trust the people who sit in their, who come to their office, to their places of worship, to trust the intellect of the people that they can take and receive the Word of God without being spoon-fed. Trust the people's intellect. That's the challenge.
Okay, Betty Brandt.
I think maybe it's back to what Carol said a little bit ago, which is about hospitality and the welcoming of people in the doors of any house of worship, and to let people know that they really are welcomed in that place and can become a part of that community instead of being little enclaves of specialness or enclaves of having to believe in one certain way. So the opening up of that hospitality to welcome people, I think, is crucial.
Carol Johnston, it's almost as if she set you up there.
Well, I agree. Hospitality is really a key to the answer. And of course, the challenge is that it's relationships, and relationships are very labor-intensive and take a lot of time and a lot of commitment. And that's the biggest challenge of all.
I want to thank you for this conversation. We got an email from Charles Crenshaw, who actually was taking issue, I think, a bit with the program, says there are other traditions than Islam and Christianity in the States. Why not representatives of Judaism, Hinduism, and Buddhism? What does this say about this dialogue? What it says is we have a relatively small studio, and that this is an ongoing conversation. We hope to continue having this and having as many different representatives, as many faith traditions as possible. I'd like to thank Betty Brandt, Director of Spiritual Life at St. Luke's United Methodist Church, Michael Sahir, Imam of Nur Allah Islamic Center here in Indianapolis, and Carol Johnston, Associate Professor of Theology and Culture, Christian Theological Seminary, for being my guest. I found this to be a fascinating conversation. I hope, as part of the ongoing discussion, we can have you all back sometime and that you'd be willing to do this again. We're going to be back next week with one of the other subjects that we're not supposed to talk about, politics and lobbying. And that will be at noon next Thursday. Please do join us. I'm John Kroll, your host. I've enjoyed spending this time with you. See you next week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. Board Engineers, Matt Sosi and Josh Hamig. And Intern, Savannah Rains. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, and you can listen online at WFYI.org.